Hello and welcome aboard the Story Arc. I'm your captain, Kenny Mears, and I am so excited to bring you along for today's Best of 2025 special. So, today we have a collection of 8 stories that are some of our personal favorites, as well as some that you guys, our audience, have voted as some of your favorites of the year. To give you an idea of how this is going to run, we are going to alternate between funny and heartwarming stories. And then at the very end, we've got a couple of scary stories. So if you do get scared easily and don't want to listen, after the 6th story, we will have a couple of scary ones. So be prepared for that. And without further ado, let me introduce our very first story, one of our earliest ones. It is called If a Feller Could Get Himself a Bear Cub, and it is contributed by my own grandfather, David Farnsworth, and it is just delightful and funny. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy the story.
My name's Dave Farnsworth. I live in Sandy, Utah. And I've been asked to speak on what type of adventures I've had. And I love to be out of doors. I love to be on mountaintops. I love to hike on trails. And I like to be run rivers. Of course, anytime you're out of doors, you have to be aware of the various risks that you may encounter as you're going about your adventures. For an example, if you were out on a hike and you came into a meadow, and what if you looked across the meadow and there was a bear? Now, you need to know the proper procedure how to behave around that bear. The first thing you want to do is just kind of move away from the bear, keep watching the bear, and kind of back up off the trail. And likely as not, if that bear happens to see you, he's going to turn and do the same thing and kind of move off in the other direction. If there happens to be a bear cub around, make sure that you do not get between that bear cub and that mama bear, because that mama bear is very protective of that little cub, and you're going to find yourself in trouble. If the bear becomes aggressive, then you want to stand tall and look like you're bigger than you are, and maybe even pound your chest and act like you're big and strong and all of that. What you don't want to do is run. If you run, that mama bear is going to look at you and assume that there's something worth catching there, and so she'll chase you. And in an out-and-out foot race between you and that bear, odds are the bear is going to win. So those are just some tips that we've learned over the years as we've been out of doors. And I really can't end talking about these bears without telling you about my Uncle Hal. His real name's Harold, but Uncle Hal had a unique characteristic in that he had what they call animal magnetism. Why, when he was out in the woods, he'd have a circle of birds circling around his head, and the squirrels and the chipmunks would come up and get close to him, because they just for some reason the animals were attracted to him. The other unique thing about Hal is that he was always trying to figure a way to turn this animal magnetism characteristic of his into cash. I mean, he always was looking for a shortcut business-wise where he could find some way that he didn't have to work and it could generate for cash. And his mind was always buzzing with new ideas and things that he could do. But one day he was out on a hike, and he comes up into that meadow and looked across, and there was a little bear cub sitting out in the middle of that, eating berries off of a bush. And he kind of watched that bear cub. He didn't want to go ahead and get close to it in case there was a mother bear around. But he waited for what he said was a pretty long time, which for him means 2 or 3 minutes. And then his mind starts to working on this idea. He says, you know, if a feller could get himself a bear cub and train it, so teach it some tricks. And, you know, because of his animal magnetism, he figured he would have a head start in being able to take this little bear cub and turn him into something. And then people pay a good dollar to see these tricks of this full-grown bear. And he kept thinking about how he could do this and turn that little cub into something that maybe make him a little bit of money. And so he figures, well, let's just go over and see if the bear cub likes me. And so he starts walking into the meadow. Never did see the mama bear at that point in time. Well, the bear cub looks up, and there might have been a little bit of attraction to it, but I think that bear cub was used to following its mother's advice, which is stranger danger. And so the little bear cub figures, well, this guy's about as strange as they come. And so he takes off and heads out of the meadow. Well, just like if you run from a bear, Hal figures, if that little cub's running away from me, I ought to chase it. So he chases it out of the meadow, and they come into this big grove of trees. Now, in the middle of this grove of trees, there had been at one time in history a huge tree. I mean, we're talking something that probably got struck by lightning, and the lightning dirt burned down into it. So now it was a stump maybe 6 to 10 feet tall, and it was hollow inside. And he's looking around, and he can't find that little cub anywhere. He can't see it. And he walks over to that stump and walks around it a few times, and he can hear there's something inside that stump that's fallen down inside there. So he climbs up some branches and what have you, the stumps of branches, and looks over, and I'll be darned if that little bear cub is down in the hole in that inside of that tree. Well, so he kind of lets himself down into this bear cub, figuring he's going to rescue the bear cub, and then of course he'll have the bear cub that he can train ticks and make lots of money. Well, he gets down there, and that little bear cub didn't have quite the same vision of the future that he did. And bears have sharp teeth and they got claws, and this isn't turning out quite the way he thought it would. And then he gets to looking, and the outside of this old tree stump was studded with where branches were, and there were places that you could grab hold of and climb up on, but the inside was pretty darn smooth. And there wasn't any way to get out. And this little bear cub was just starting to claw him and to bite for him. And he's thinking, this isn't such a good idea. This is maybe I've made a mistake here and I can't figure out how to get out of here. Just then he sees the backside of the mama bear coming down. She had heard the commotion, seen what was going on, and she was coming down at the inside of that stump in order to rescue her bear cub. And, of course, because of the smoothness on the inside, she had to come down butt first. Well, he's thinking, Mama Bear gets down here, and I'm in big trouble. He's thinking, what can I do? Well, he, like most people when they're out hiking, he had a utility knife on him. And it's pretty sharp. And he takes that knife out, and he sees as the bear starts coming down, he pokes her with this knife. And the Mama Bear, of course, feels that pain, and she climbs back, shoots back up to the top. In the meantime, Hal grabs her little tail, and that, of course, pulls him up so that he's now on the very edge, and they both the bear and Hal, fall out of the tree stump. And, of course, it's a pretty good little drop down to the ground, and they kind of, you know, a little bit stunned as they hit the ground, and they stand up and brush themselves off, and he's thinking, well, at least I didn't break anything getting out of there, and Mama Bear probably was thinking something close to that. And then the Mama Bear looks over and sees Hal, and she figures, he's the cause of this problem right here. So she starts to chase him. Now, in an out-and-out flat, going across the meadow type race, that mama bear is going to win. Hal knows this. I mean, he's been out of doors a lot, and he knows his way around. So what he's doing is he's going around the tree. And a bear takes a few minutes to get around that tree as well. As they're running around, the bear would kind of come up and claw at him. And, of course, he'd run extra fast, and he'd find himself running up so that he was almost coming up behind the bear. And then, of course, he'd get tired, and Mama Bear would come around. This went on for a couple times around the tree. He's thinking, this can't go on forever. And he still has that knife in his hand. And he's thinking, well, gosh, something's got to change here. And so as he comes up, the next time he catches up to the Mama Bear, and he takes that knife, and he cuts off a big chunk of meat off of her backside and just drops it there in the middle of the trail. Mama Bear goes around, and she sees that piece of meat, and she eats it. Well, come around, they do that again, and he cuts off another piece of it. She comes around and sees another piece of meat, and she eats it. Well, this went on and on most of the day until, well, finally, that mama bear just ate herself to death. Now, another story, since we're talking about bears, is I got to tell you about Willie Farnsworth. He was another cousin, and Willie Farnsworth was a real good member of the church. And he had two loves. One was the church, and the other was he loved to hunt. I mean, he hunted deer, and he hunted elk, and he hunted ducks. And him and his brother, every year, they'd put in for a permit to hunt bear. Now, they didn't figure they'd ever draw out, because it's just something that doesn't happen very often. You'd go your whole lifetime and never get one of those permits. There's only a half dozen maybe in the entire state that get drawn out on that. One day, Willie is is called into the stake president's office. And the stake president said, "We're going to have a change in the bishopric, and your name has come up, and we'd like to ask you to be the bishop." Now, you do understand that if you accept this, that this is a commitment of your time. I mean, we know you like to hunt, and you're gone quite a few of the weekends with your hunting, but this is a commitment, and your first priority is to the Lord. So if you take this, you need to be aware of that. And so he goes home and he talks to his wife, and his real name was William B. Farnsworth. So they kind of changed his name to William B. because that was more noteworthy as being the bishop of the ward. And he accepted the calling and became the bishop of the ward. He served very well. If they did hunting, they did it during the week, and him and his brother were getting along fine. But just because of the tradition of putting in a permit to get a permit to hunt bear, he figured they're still going to put it in. Odds are they weren't going to get it, and so they both put in permits to hunt bear. And I'll be darned if his name doesn't draw out, and he's now got a permit to go hunting bear. Well, he figures in the back of his mind, I mean, you know how your mind works. He's thinking, maybe this is the Lord blessing me for being a good bishop and for doing my duties. And so he gets his brother, and they go out the first of the week. And on Monday, they start hunting bear up in the area where they were allowed to do this. And, hey, they didn't see a single sign. Monday comes along. Tuesday comes along. Wednesday. And they keep going further and further back into the woods looking for a sign of the bear. They run across another hiker, and he says, "If you go up into this next valley over, I saw some sign of a bear up in that area, and so there might be some there." Now it's Thursday, Friday, so they work their way up into that part of the country, and now it's Saturday, and they're starting to see a little bit of sign of this bear, and they're thinking they're so close, and they're a long way from their truck. It had taken 2 or 3 days just to hike back out of there to get back to their truck anyway, so they're pretty well committed to do this even on Sunday. And they said, "Well, we'll just maybe have our own little sacrament meeting on Sunday and take care of it that way." And I'll be darned. So they get up Sunday morning, and I'll be darned if he doesn't see a bear out across this meadow. And so he goes over hunting the bear, and he gets closer and he gets closer. And he pulls his rifle up and he aims it at that bear and pulls the trigger, and it goes click. Well, the bear heard that click. It did not fire around. So he figures, well, something's wrong either with my gun or with the ammunition. So he cocks it again, and he gets another click off. By now, that bear's coming for him. He knows that it's him or William B. Farnsworth that's going to win this little battle. And so finally, he realizes he can't trust his gun, or he drops the gun, and he starts running away. And he drops down off of this little bit almost a cliff, and there's a stream down there, and he's starting to go across that stream, and all of a sudden he feels the claw of that bear on his back, and it pushes him over, and now he's finding himself face down in the water, and he turns his head to catch a breath of air, and he hears a deep gravelly voice, and he's being held down into the water by the bear, and what he hears is the bear say, "And thank you, Lord, for this meal with which you have provided me with. May I provide me with the nutrition, and may I use it to do good. Amen." And that was the last thing that William B. Farnsworth ever heard.
Our next story comes from friend of the show, Stephanie Rollhazer. And this is the very first story that she ever contributed to the show. We have titled it, "He Pulled Out a Rather Large Envelope." And it is a delightful story of dance, approaching your crush, and young love. Please sit back and enjoy.
My name is Stephanie Rollhazer. I am originally from Kansas City, Missouri, though I lived in Atlanta for 30 years prior to my almost 19 years here in Salt Lake City, Utah. I have my degree in acting, but went into corporate America for about 30 years. And since retiring back in 2020, have gotten back into acting and storytelling. I told my very first story back in 1989, if you can believe it. That certainly dates me. Friendships are forged, battles fought, wars waged, destinies won. These are the dramas that play themselves out every single day all across the world in high school lunchrooms. And the same is true in 1932 when one of the best love stories ever written began. You see, it wasn't your ordinary kind of love. It's the kind of love that courses through your veins and lights up your very being. Because in the cafeteria of St. Peter's Catholic School, Giuseppe Tutorino and Filomena Presta, Joe and Minnie, my grandparents, met for the very first time. My grandfather had an unrequited crush on my grandmother for so very long, and she wouldn't give him the time of day. Now, if Grandpa were here today, this is the part of the story where he would interrupt and he would say, Minnie was in the smart class, I was in the dummy class. And my grandmother would laugh and with mock mortification, pat his little hand and say, now, Joe, you know that's not true. Grandpa was more of a tradesman. My grandma had earned the moniker of CFO of the family, but they weren't even in the same year. I can promise you that there wasn't a day that went by that my grandfather wasn't thinking about my grandmother and how he was going to meet her. But it seemed like he was foiled at every turn, every time he stood in the doorway to the lunchroom, waiting for her to come through and walk by. She wouldn't even glance in his direction, wouldn't give him the time of day. Every time he flashed his biggest, best smile at her, she was looking in another direction, watching something else. And every time he tried to put some obstacle in between the two of them so that she would be forced to stop and have a conversation with him, inexplicably and inevitably, she was always diverted in another direction. He was so frustrated. How was he going to meet this woman who was the love of his life? Well, a solution presented itself. Posters all around the school showed that there was a dance that was coming up, and this meant my grandpa would have to talk to her. He had made up his mind he was going to ask her to the dance. He practiced over and over and over again the night before, and then surrounded and emboldened by his siblings and his friends, he waited for her to come into that cafeteria. And he waited. And he waited. Where was she? He could hear the clanking of the trays. He could hear the silverware scraping back and forth, the brown paper bags rustling. And all of a sudden, there she was, Minnie Presta. His heart started beating out of his chest. He got so nervous. His little palms were all sweaty. And all of a sudden, all that rehearsal went right out the window because he blurted out, hello, Minnie. I don't know if you're aware, but there's a dance coming up and I sure would like to take you. Oh my gosh, he had done it. He had said it. Well, a look came over my grandma's face, a little bit of pity and a little bit of compassion. And she said, oh, Joe, I can't go with you. You don't know how to dance. What? Did she say Joe? Did she just say Joe? She knew his name. She knew who he was. He was so excited. He was beside himself. It literally took him a few minutes to realize she'd actually turned him down. And not just turned him down. She'd sort of insulted him a little bit, though it was true. He couldn't dance. Oh, he was crestfallen. He was devastated, crushed. And I so many times wish that I had stopped to ask the question, what did you do, Grandpa? Did you just stand there and let her walk away? Did you go home and try to practice dancing in front of the mirror? Did you ask your brothers and sisters to help? What did you do? Well, I don't know what actually happened in the in-between time. But I do know what transpired in the end. A few weeks later, my grandfather, very confident in his Sunday best, marched through that cafeteria and walked right up to where my grandma stood with her friends about to sit down for their lunch. And he said, Minnie, as you know, there's a dance coming up and I would like for you to go with me. A hush fell over the cafeteria. What? All eyes turned towards them. Forks, st- stopped and were suspended in midair, food hanging precariously over the edge. Everybody knew Grandma had turned him down. What was he thinking? My grandma looked a little nonplussed at him and thought, I thought I gave him a pretty good reason why I didn't want to go. And so she reiterated, Joe, I can't go with you. You don't know how to dance. Everybody waited. What would Grandpa do? He opened the lapel of his suit coat, pulled out a rather large envelope, and with a hand that was shaking just a little, started to pull out a thick piece of paper. Grandma said she could just make out the gold embossed arched letters over the top. Arthur Murray. He pulled the paper the rest of the way out and he handed it to my grandmother. It was a certificate from the Arthur Murray School of Dance. My grandfather had gone to take lessons. Now, I come from a very long line of Sicilian-Italian peasants on my grandfather's side, so I have no idea how he was able to afford this. I don't know if he did some fancy negotiating, or if, more than likely, he scraped together every last penny of his life savings. Whatever the cost, whatever the price, whatever the sacrifice, he had deemed her worthy. And let me tell you, go to that dance they did as my great uncle Chester watched and chaperoned. They moved across that floor to every single song the band played that night. And their love, the love that courses through your veins and lights up your entire being, was sealed. And I can promise you, all those years later, when that horrible disease had ravaged my grandfather's mind and wiped every memory of St. Peter's Catholic School from it, as my grandfather lay in his hospital bed in the sunroom of my mom's house, and Grandma would clean his feeding tube and change his diapers and adjust his covers, every single time she looked into his eyes, she saw that handsome, brave, debonair, courageous young man she had fallen in love with all those years ago in the cafeteria of St. Peter's Catholic School. And I am forever blessed to have witnessed one of the greatest love stories of all time.
Isn't that such a lovely story? I absolutely love it. My family has a history of dance being a big part of our family, and so that story just hits me in the feels. Our next story comes from friend of the show Elizabeth Gibson, and it is another heartwarming one known as The Cat and the Camellias. It combines the ideas of the afterlife, messages from our dearly departed loved ones, and, oddly enough, some cats bringing flowers. Enjoy.
This next supernatural tale is actually a family history story. And it's pretty self-explanatory, but it's another southern one coming from our home state. The Cat and the Camellias. Does love survive death? Can love be powerful enough to punch a hole in the veil that separates the living from the dead in order to bring a message of hope and love to those left behind? You be the judge. Two sisters sit across from one another in a dimly lit farmhouse kitchen. The night is hot and humid, so the door to the outside stands open. And a screen door stands as the only protection between the insect travelers in the night drawn to the light bulb overhead and the occupants of the house. A breeze wafts through the door, and on it is the pulsing sound of the chirping crickets and harumphing the bullfrogs that fill the night air. And out in that black darkness, the winking light of lightning bugs pierces with their brilliant lights. It's midsummer in North Carolina. Jess Mahazel and Peggy Ann, 2 years apart in age, were born and raised on a tobacco farm in north central North Carolina, growing up in the Depression. In adulthood, Jessma went west to seek her fortune, while Peggy Ann remained and married and settled down near the old farmhouse. The thousands of miles that then separated them only served to bring their hearts closer together. And now, on a rare visit home for Jessma, the two are spending the evening packing in years' worth of conversation in just this one night. They speak of husbands and their careers, children, places they've been, people that they've met. But as the hours of the evening begin to grow later, the conversation starts to take a more serious turn towards the intangibles of life, Jessma's growing homesickness for the old place, Peggy Ann's concerns over her worsening emphysema. They even discuss the old tales from their youth that came from the conjure woman that lived down the road from the farmhouse, and her old haint stories, her ghost tales. Something is bothering Peggy Ann. She turns to Jessma and says, "Jessma, I wish so deeply that when a loved one passes, they could send a sign to those of us left behind, something more tangible, so that we know that they're all right and they still are watching over us and love us. Yeah, the Bible is a definite comfort to me, but I wish we could have something tangible. I think that whoever goes first between us should send the other one a sign. If I go first, what sign do you want me to send you?" Well, Jessma was a bit taken aback by the serious turn of the conversation, so in an attempt to lighten things up a bit, she turned to Peggy Ann and said, "Well, please don't send me any haints. No ghosts, thank you. I just think we should send each other our favorite flower. Mine's a pink camellia. You can send me that." "And how shall I send it to you?" Peggy Ann asked. Well, right at that moment, there was a scritching and a scratching down at the screen door. They both turned to look, and there sitting right behind the screen door was a black cat. This marvelously inky creature had the most unusual markings, for around its throat was a ring of white dots that gave it the appearance of wearing a string of pearls, which only added to its air of mystery and elegance. Seeing this little unexpected visitor, Jessma turned back to Peggy Ann and said, "You can send me my flower by a cat." Well, that was funny. So Peggy Ann and Jessma, they laughed, and Peggy Ann got up and fed the little stranger at the door, and they talked a little bit longer, and then they went to bed. A couple days later, Jessma left for home, having forgotten all about the conversation. Several months later, Peggy Ann, her emphysema began to really worsen. And even though she was only 47 years of age, it took her down very quickly. When news of her death reached Jessma, she was set to wrestling about whether or not she should go back to North Carolina for the funeral where she had just been, or remain at home. Eventually, she realized she did not want to see her sister lying in a coffin. She wanted to remember her the way she had been. She resolved to stay in California and just do her grieving there. A couple of weeks later, one morning, Jessma woke up full of dreams of Peggy Ann and so many thoughts about all the things they had planned to do one day. For instance, they had both said that they wanted to write the stories of their childhood growing up in the Depression on a tobacco farm and put it into a book. Jessma was going to do the writing, and Peggy Ann, a very talented artist, was going to do the illustrations. Now, all that would come to naught. But just after that thought, another one came in right behind it for Jessma. Well, you could do it. Huh. Jessma was mulling that over in her mind as she got up, as she did every day, went into the living room to open the drapes at the sliding glass door and let in that California sunshine. And as she did so, something caught her eye down on the outdoor green carpeting on the porch. She looked down, and there was a flower. She unlocked and opened the door, and she picked the blossom up, mulled it over in her hands, and it was the most beautiful and perfect pink camellia. Jessma said, "Well, now, how did that get there?" Coming up with nothing, absolutely nothing, she took the blossom, went back into the kitchen, got down a crystal bowl from the cabinets, put water in it, sit down on the counter, and put the pink camellia in the bowl of water, and then went about her day. The next morning, she was leaving out of the front door for reasons that in years later, telling it, she couldn't remember why. But when she opened the front door, there, right down on the welcome mat, was another perfectly formed, beautiful pink camellia. Jessma reached down, picked up the blossom, and this time she said out loud to no one in particular, "Who's sending me flowers?" And coming up with absolutely nothing, she took that blossom, went back into the kitchen, placed it in the bowl next to the first one, and went on about her day. For the next 5 days, single and sometimes double blossoms appeared at either her front or her back door, sometimes both during the day. On the fifth day, Jessma was leaving for a doctor's appointment. She opened the front door, went out, locked it, opened the garage, got into the car, and as she was adjusting her rearview mirror, she saw the strangest sight. There, coming down the middle of the black tar road, was her white cat, Snow, with something in its mouth. Jessma leapt out of the car and called the cat over. "Here, Snow! Here, Snow! Come here!" And the kitty came trotting up. Jessma reached down and pulled from its mouth another perfect and beautiful pink camellia. That's when the gears began to turn in her head, and she thought, "Wait a minute, what was it that we said about a sign? If one of us dies first, we send the other a sign. What should it be? Send flowers. Mine's a pink camellia. How shall I send it? I will send it by a cat." Now Jessma knew where the flowers were coming from. Peggy was sending them. This filled her heart full of such gratitude. "Peggy is still seeing me. We still love each other. She sent me a sign. She's happy." And that was the last time that Jessma received a pink camellia. Now, I ask you, does love survive death? Is it ever strong enough to punch a hole between the living and the dead, to send a message of hope and love to those left behind? Well, to Jessma Hazel Smith Gibson, my mother-in-law, to all her children and their grandchildren, some of whom have heard this story since it happened in 1975, the resounding answer is yes. But Jessma tells it best. She said, "You know, over the years since that happened, I would go from nursery to nursery in California trying to find a pink camellia bush with blossoms as beautiful as the ones that came to me. But I could never find one that beautiful. Now I know why. Because mine were designed just for me by my beloved sister.
Isn't that such a sweet story of sisterly love? It's a great one, one of our favorites. And our next story comes from friend of the show, Randall McGee. And this is one of the earlier ones that he's contributed to us as well. And it is hilarious. It is known as Silly Hans. It is a Hans Christian Andersen story. And Randall tells it as though he himself is Hans Christian Andersen. So sit back, enjoy, and get ready for a laugh.
Hello, I'm Randall McGee. I am a full-time performer, storyteller, ventriloquist. I have been telling stories for as long as I can remember, since I was a child. And about 30 years ago now, as I was telling stories, I discovered that Hans Christian Andersen, the famous author and storyteller of such great tales as The Ugly Duckling and The Little Mermaid, was also a paper cut artist, which is what I've been incorporating into my storytelling performances for many years. So I researched the stories of Hans Christian Andersen, his life and times, and I've created a separate act from some of my other work, where I portray Hans Christian Andersen. So the story I'd like to share with you today, in Danish, it's called Klot Hans. I translate that into Silly Hans. It's a story that I've really enjoyed over the years. It's one of those wise fool sort of stories with a little twist at the end. So we'll pretend that we're sitting in a Danish manor house with all the guests around, and H.C. Andersen, H.C. Andersen, is here to share a story with you today. Outside of Odense, where I was born, there was a great manor house. There lived a very rich man. He was very proud of his large estate, of his cattle, his fields, and he was also most proud of his two sons. And his two sons were most proud of themselves. Yeah, they were very self-absorbed. They went to a very good school, and one of the sons, he memorized all of the words in the dictionary so that he could speak very well, and he also read all of the newspapers so that he was always up on current events. The second son said, "I can do better than that," and he memorized all of the laws of the land. And he was able to embroider little designs on his suspenders, so he thought he could talk about the arts. Now, one day, to the manor house, there came a messenger from the palace. "The princess has declared that she will marry the man who can speak to her the best." When the brothers heard this announcement, they were so excited, for surely one of them would be able to speak to the princess the best. And so they practiced for a few days in front of the mirror, speaking clearly and distinctly. The first brother, he rubbed his jaws with cod liver oil. It made his jaws very flexible so that he could speak. The other brother said, "I can do better than that." And he gargled with the salt, with the cod liver oil. Oh, it tasted terrible. But it worked to make his tongue quick, and his words as smooth as oil. So once they were ready, the rich man brought forth his two best horses for his sons to ride to the palace. To the first son, who had memorized all the words of the dictionary and the newspaper articles, he gave a horse that was white as milk. And to the second son, who had memorized all the laws of the land and could embroider his suspenders very nicely, he gave a horse that was black as coal. All of the servants came out to see them off. But the brothers paid no attention to them. They held their noses high in the air. They climbed on their horses and they clicked their heels. Yeah! And off they rode to see the princess, to speak to her the best. But just then, out of the rich man's house, boom, 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 running down the stairs, came the third son. Now, I have not mentioned him before because they did not pay much attention to him. He did not brag about learning things, but he did read. He read stories, and he would often share the stories with the children of the servants. His brothers and his father thought this was a silly waste of time, and since his name was Hans, they called him Silly Hans. And so it was that Silly Hans was running down the stairs, boom, 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 and he called after his brothers, "Brothers, brothers, wait, stop, where are you going?" Well, the brothers stopped their horses, whoa, for that is how you stop a horse, you know, and they turned and they said, "Silly Hans, didn't you hear the proclamation that the princess will declare, that the princess will marry the man who can speak to her the best? Surely one of us will win her hand. Farewell. Goodbye." And they turned and clicked their heels. Yeah. And off they rode to see the princess, to speak to her the best. Well, now, Silly Hans was excited, and he turned to his father and said, "Father, would you please give me a horse that I might ride with my brothers to see the princess and speak to her the best?" His father said, "Oh, Silly Hans, you do not read dictionaries or important things like law books. You just read storybooks. I'm not going to waste one of my horses on you." "Well," said Silly Hans, "I'm going to see the princess and speak to her the best so that she will marry me. And even if she doesn't want to, I'll probably marry her anyway. So if you won't give me a horse, I'll ride what I have." And Silly Hans went out to the barn and he pulled out his billy goat. He had raised it from a kid, and now it was a great beast with a shaggy back and long curly horns. He walked around and shook hands with all of the servants and said, "Goodbye, goodbye." And they all said, "Good luck, good luck." And he climbed on the billy goat and he clicked his heels. Yeah! Blah, 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 and off he bounced on the billy goat. But it wasn't long before he caught up with his brothers. And he had made up a little song to go along with this trip. It was, "Here I am, here I am, I'm coming to marry the princess." And he yelled, "Brothers, stop, wait, see what I have found." Well, the brothers stopped their horses. Whoa! And they turned, and Silly Hans held up in his hand a dead crow. The brother said, "Silly Hans, that is a dead crow. Are you taking that to the princess?" "Yes," he said, "I'm sure she doesn't have anything like this in the castle." The brothers laughed. "Oh, I'm sure." And they turned and clicked their heels. Yeah! Boom. And off they rode to see the princess and speak to her the best. Well, it wasn't long before Silly Hans caught up with him again, singing his little song. "Here I am, here I am, I'm coming to marry the princess. Brother, stop and see what new wonder I have found." The brothers again stopped their horses. Whoa! They turned, and Silly Hans held up an old wooden shoe. It was broken on the back. It had been thrown away. And the brother said, "Silly Hans, that's an old shoe the farmer has thrown out. Are you taking that to the princess?" "Yes, I am," he said. "I'm sure it will come in very handy somewhere." Well, they laughed, but they turned, clicked their heels, yeah, and they rode off even faster, blum, 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 leaving Silly Hans in the dust. But once again, he caught up with him, singing his little song. "Here I am, here I am, I'm coming to marry the princess. Oh, brother, stop and see the treasure I have found." Well, they stopped their horses. Whoa! And they turned, and in his hands, Silly Hans held gobs of mud, black and gooey mud. The brother said, "Silly Hans, that is mud from the ditch. Are you taking that to the princess?" "Oh, yes, I am," he said. "It is the best mud. See, you can make mud pies." And They didn't wait to hear the rest. They clicked their heels, yah, and off they rode, leaving silly Hans again in the dust. Well, the two brothers arrived at the palace hours before silly Hans was able to catch up, and they were pushed into a room that was full of men, all there thinking that they could speak to the princess the best. And these brothers became very envious and jealous. They became angry, and it was good that they were all pushed together, because they probably would have ended up fighting with others. And one by one, the men were shown into a different room, and then the guards would come out and take another man, and so forth, until the room was empty except for the two brothers. And then the guards came, and they grabbed the first brother and pushed him through the door. And the first brother entered the princess's throne room, but he was so surprised, for the room had furnaces in each corner that were bellowing forth flames and heat. There was a giant mirror on the ceiling, so when he looked up, he could see himself upside down on the ceiling. And at the other side of the room, on her throne sat the princess, with a very cold, hard look on her face. On each side of the princess, there were two tables, and at each table there sat two scribes. The scribes were the men who were writing everything down for the royal family. And on this particular day, they were writing everything the men said to the princess and then sending it off to the newspapers for all the world to read. Well, the first brother came in, saw the furnaces himself on the ceiling, and the princess with the cold, hard look, and the scribes writing everything down. And nervously, he approached and said, "Hello, Your Highness. I am here to speak to you the best, but it is incredibly, unbelievably hot in here today. Why is that?" And the princess with that cold, hard look said, "That is because we are roasting roosters." And the brother, who knew all of the words of the dictionary, could only go, "Huh?" And the scribes at their table, they wrote down, "Huh?" And the princess yelled, "No good, throw him out." So the guards marched up, they grabbed the brother. Wait, what are you doing? Ah, boom. They tossed him out the window. And then the guard pushed that second brother in, the one who had memorized all the laws and could embroider his suspenders. He came in, saw himself on the ceiling upside down, saw the furnaces bellowing forth flames and heat, and the princess with a very cold, hard look on her face. And he became so nervous, his legs began to shake. But still, he came forward and said, "Hello, Your Highness, I am here to speak to you the best, but it is unlawfully hot in here today. Oh, why is that?" And the princess with her cold, hard look said, "That is because we are roasting roosters today." And this brother, who knew all the laws of the land, could only say, "Huh?" And the scribes on the tables wrote, "Huh?" And the princess yelled, "No good! Throw him out!" And so the guards picked him up. Wait, oh no, blah, boom! And threw him out the window. Well, just then, the palace doors burst open. And in came silly Hans, still riding on his billy goat, still singing his song, which you probably know by now. "Here I am, here I am, I'm coming to marry the princess. Whoa, goat, whoa, stop, whoa." And he jumped off the billy goat and said, "Hello, princess, I am Silly Hans. I am here to speak to you the best. But it is very hot in here. Why is that?" The princess with her cold, hard look said, "That is because we are roasting roosters today." And Silly Hans smiled and said, "Oh, good. Then perhaps you could cook my crow also." And he held up the dead crow. Well, this was different. And that cold, hard look on the princess's face softened just a bit, so at the corner of her mouth you could see a little bit of a smile. like that. And she said, well, we would roast your crow, but we've run out of pots or pans. That is all right, said Silly Hans. I brought my own pot. And he held up the old wooden shoe. And he put the crow down into the pot and said, look, it's already cooked to where it's black. Shall we eat? This was very different. And that smile went from one side of her mouth over to the other side, making a complete smile. And she said, well, we can't eat just yet, for we have no gravy for our meal. What do you think about that? And Silly Hans said, I have gravy enough for us all, and you probably know what's coming now. He reached into his pockets and he pulled out the mud. Yeah, he pulled out the mud and he said, I have gravy enough for all. Shall we eat? Well, the princess, she was smiling widely. At this point, she said, oh, but I must tell you that these men are my scribes and they are writing everything down that you say to send to the newspapers for all the world to read. So what do you think about that? Silly Hans said, oh, they are so important, I think we should serve the scribes first. And with that, he threw those gobs of mud whoosh, right into the faces of those scribes. And on their papers they wrote, I don't know how to spell that. But anyway, the princess, she stood up, she clapped her hands and she laughed and she said, I don't know how you did that, but I'm sure that you will teach me, for you are the man who has spoken to me the best. You are the man that I wish to marry. Silly Hans smiled and said, I thought you would. Well, soon after that, they were married, and he became good Prince Hans, and they lived for many happy years together. And do you know, this story is true. It is true, you see, because I read the newspapers and that contain that story, and you can always believe what you read in the newspapers, can't you?
Isn't Randall just a hoot? That is such a fun story. I love it. And our next story is another heartwarming one from friend of the show Laurie Allen. It is a Ukrainian folktale known as The Mitten. So sit back and enjoy.
My name is Laurie Allen, and I have been storytelling for longer than my children can remember. I love stories. I love the things that they teach us and the entertaining value. Today, it seems timely to share a folktale from the Ukraine. And this is probably their most famous folktale, and it's called The Mitten. Everyone knew that Baba's knitting was the best in the entire forest and in the entire area. It was so beautiful. What she could do with those needles was pure magic. It was colorful, the stitches were even and perfect, and it was sturdy. What she knitted was meant to last. Now, Baba was Yvonne's grandmother. That's what Baba is, grandmother. And Yvonne was ready one day, one cold winter day, to go outside. The snow was beautiful, the sun was shining, and it was all sparkly. And so he grabbed his boots, he put on his parka, he put on his hat, and he put on his scarf and Baba's wonderful mittens. And he went outside to play. Now, he's an 8-year-old boy. He ran all over. He loved to see the snow on the trees. And he loved to go into the forest and see if he could tell what animal tracks there were in the snow. And he played and he ran far and wide, for he knew the area, and Baba did not worry too much about him getting lost. But as he played and the sun shone down, he began to get warm. And so he took those mittens off and he pushed them in his pocket. And he ran off and he played some more. And then the sky clouded up, a storm was coming in, and he ran for home. Now, what Yvonne did not know is that by shoving both mittens in one pocket, one of them had fallen out. He hadn't noticed. And it was lying there on the white snow in the forest. When he got home, Baba looked, realized he'd lost a mitten, shook her head and sat him down in front of the fireplace with a cup of hot chocolate. Meanwhile, in the forest, there was a little mouse, and this mouse was so cold, the snow was coming down so hard, the wind was blowing, and she was running through the forest, and she suddenly saw something brightly colored lying on top of the white snow. And she peeked inside. Nothing was in there, but it was warm, and she ran inside that mitten. Oh, her frozen whiskers began to thaw. She felt so good. And this was a good place to wait out the storm. Well, it wasn't very long before a frog came along.
Ribbit, 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 ribbit.
And the frog saw this mitten in the snow and peeked inside. And there was just a little mouse in there. And he said,
ribbit, ribbit, can I come in? Come on, I mean, I'm so cold.
Certainly you can come in. And so the frog hopped in and they both snuggled down into that mitten. Then a rabbit came by. And the rabbit looked, and this mitten was moving a little bit now with the two animals inside it. And she looked inside, and she said, Oh, I am so cold. I've been hopping, and I am so cold. Can I come in? Sure, you can come in. And so the rabbit wiggled her way into that mitten. Well, it was not very long before a fox came by, and this fox had been caught outside of his den, and he was so cold his tail was freezing. And he saw this moving mitten in the snow, and he poked his little red nose inside. And it looked so cozy and warm. And he said, Oh, my tail is frozen. My tail is frozen. Can I come in? Yes, you can come in, said the mouse. And the fox worked his way into the mitten. And the mitten just expanded to fit all of those animals. Well, after a short amount of time, a wolf came by. And this wolf, well, he was a long way from home, too. And his ears were just frozen. And he saw this mitten or something moving around on the snow. And he went and he stuck his muzzle in and he said, Oh, this looks warm. I am frozen. My ears are so cold. Can I come in? Yes, yes, you can come in. And so the wolf worked his way in, and the mitten just stretched and expanded. But Baba's stitching still held. Well, the next thing they knew, a boar came along. A boar with his big tusks, and he was getting really cold, too, and I'm so cold, and what is that? And he saw this mitten, and by this time it's moving around and wriggling, and he went, and he stuck his nose and one of his tusks inside and said, warmth, can I come in? Well, yes, said the mouse, you can come in, too. And he worked his way in. It took him a minute to work his way in. And there he was, nice and warm. And this mitten just expanded further. Well, they were all very cozy now in the storm. They could see the snow coming down, still coming outside. But they were all warm. With all of them in there, they were really warm. And next, a bear came by. This bear had come out from hibernation on the sunny day and now got caught in the middle of this storm. And he looked, and he couldn't tell what it was at first. All this wriggling in the snow and all this color. And then he realized it was a place to get warm. And he peeked his nose inside and he said, Oh, I am so cold. I am cold. I am so cold. And could I come in? Because that looks so warm and I am so cold. Sure, come in, said the mouse, if you can fit. And that bear worked his way in and finally got himself to where he was turned around so that just his tip of his nose and his eyes were outside and everything else was in the mitten. And as you can imagine, that mitten had grown and grown and grown. Well, all the animals were warm and snug in their mitten. And then the sun came out. The storm stopped. And when the sun came out, the bear, whose nose and eyes were slightly peeking out, that sun hit his nose, and he started... And with that big bear sneeze, that mitten just flew apart into pieces. All the animals rushed home to their dens or their logs or their burrows or their caves and left the pieces of the mitten in the snow. Later that day, a traveler from other parts was walking through the forest, and as he did, he looked down and he saw this brightly colored piece of something that was lying in the snow, and he picked it up. And he said, "This is beautiful work. Look at those stitches. If I take that home, my wife could put that into a blanket." And he found two more fairly good-sized pieces, and he put them all into his pocket. Because after all, it would be a shame to have something that beautiful left just lying there on the forest floor.
Isn't the mitten such a cute little story? It's a fun one, one of our favorites, hence why it's here. And our next story comes from young storyteller Madeline Rollins, who is currently in college, and it is a story known as The Most Expensive Baby Blanket Ever Bought. It is a story of siblings when they are young and curious and some of the funny things that can happen in those situations. So strap in and get ready to enjoy this incredible storyteller.
My name is Madeline Rollins. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm a professional storyteller. I started storytelling about 3 years ago when I was a junior in high school, and I was a national youth storyteller. I was able to do that for both my junior and senior year, telling at showcases around the Utah Valley, as well as at the Timpanogos Storytelling Festival. Following graduation, I continued with my professional storytelling career, telling at the Weber State Storytelling Festival in February of 2025, and I continue to audition and tell stories around the Valley. I'm also a part of the Utah Storytelling Guild. The story that I'm going to tell today is a personal tale about my older sister from when I was very, very young. I usually tell personal tales as well as fairy tales and folk tales. Today, my story is called The Most Expensive Baby Blanket Ever Bought. There is an old saying that the smart people in this world learn from their own mistakes, but the wise people learn from other people's mistakes. Well, I am convinced that older sisters were invented to provide plenty of material for the wise. Now, this might seem a little bit harsh, but not only do I have an older sister, I am an older sister, and I'm pretty convinced that between the two of us, our younger siblings are going to be some of the wisest people to ever set foot on planet Earth. Now, my older sister is a fantastic example. I do learn from her mistakes, but I also learn from all of her successes. See, my older sister is about the most curious person you could ever get. Elise is... Well, she runs off of this idea of what if, as in, why don't I just use what if to explain every reason I do anything in life? What if I drop this bottle of hot pink nail polish on the driveway? Let's just see what happens. Yeah, that one didn't end up all that well. Thankfully, her what ifs as she grew older became more along the lines of, what if I auditioned for this show? What if I tried out for this choir or this sports team? And those are the successes that I got to learn about as I grew up. However, curious adults like Elise once started out as very curious children, and raising a curious child is no easy feat. And my parents will attest to this. In fact, the first time that they discovered how truly curious my older sister was before she can even remember, but they will never let her forget the story. It happened when my dad was in business school many, 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 many years ago. I was about a year old at the time. Elise was about 3, and our older brother Jacob was 2. My parents were living on campus as my dad finished up getting his master's degree. And the business school that he was a part of sent out an email with a big flyer announcing their yearly charity auction. It advertised all sorts of prizes. You could go on a private flight, or if you liked early mornings and spending time with the person in charge of your college admissions, you could go birdwatching with the dean. Those were just a couple of the options they had, but that wasn't what was drawing my parents. No. The auction had in big, bold letters the advertisement that children and families were welcome. And that meant that my parents could get a night out of the house without having to spend an hour on the phone trying to find a teenage sacrifice willing to watch their three children under the age of three. So, the night of the auction, they put me in a stroller, bundled up Elise and Jacob, and they headed out into the chilly air towards the business school. As they approached the building, they were surrounded by swarms of people coming for the auction. When they finally managed to make it through the crowd, they then had to make it up four flights of stairs using that special skill young parents have to get the stroller up the stairs without dumping out the occupant, which I am very grateful for. But when they finally made it to the auction room, it was packed. Rows upon rows of those black folding chairs used for funerals and weddings lined the room, and most of them were full. But in the very back of the room, there was a small area my parents managed to push through and settle in. As they finally got us all settled, my mother sat down and looked around and realized something was a little bit off. Although the flyer had advertised that children and families were welcome, the room was silent. And as she looked around, she realized that we were the only family in the entire room of very professional-looking people. She immediately thought back to her own teenage years of babysitting when she got tired of the Star Trek reruns and she'd watch those old auction shows where people sold off the stuff they found in their attic. Those shows where if you so much as touched your nose, not to mention made a noise, meant that you had bid your entire life savings on that old vase. She panicked, but the doors were already closed. So she dove for the diaper bag as the auctioneer came to the front of the room. She pulled out the emergency stash. We had the coloring books, the picture books. She brought out the Cheerios. It was a big deal. And immediately, Elise and Jacob dove into the goods as I, being the angel child I am, fell asleep in my stroller. 20 minutes in, my mother started to breathe again. By some miracle, there had only been silence from our corner of the room as the auction went on. Jacob was coloring, Elise was reading a book, and I was sleeping. She waited tensely for some sudden noise to determine the loss of all of our savings, but nothing. 40 minutes into the auction, she finally was able to untense. And Elise was coloring, and Jacob was reading the picture book, I was sleeping, and my dad had even managed to make a bid. 55 minutes into the auction, my mother was about to sing hallelujah. She had 5 minutes left. There were three options left on that auction table. Jacob was back to the coloring. Elise had been sitting patiently in her chair, just kind of observing. I'd been asleep. At which point, you parents in the audience and you babysitters, older siblings, anybody who's ever interacted with a little child, you probably have now noticed something is wrong. Because, let me say it again, Elise had been quietly sitting in the chair watching what was going on around her, which meant that my mother was raising an alien, or chaos was about to ensue. And as this came into her head, she turned just in time to see Elise's pudgy little legs stand up on that black folding chair as she raised her arm in the air and with her loudest three-year-old voice shouted, 20 hundred. The old professor sitting beside us, oh, he woke up. The room went more silent than it had ever been. The auctioneer peered over his glasses. He was holding up a set of three baby blankets. Nothing particularly special about them. And as my mom wrestled my sister down from the chair, my dad, who didn't know what else to do, he made eye contact with the auctioneer. And he nodded to seal the bid. Now the auction finished, and my parents were the last ones up to the table at the end. My dad leaned over and had a whispered conversation with the man at the booth. And then he pulled out his checkbook, wrote a check, handed it over, and into the happy arms of Elise was placed three baby blankets. My parents went home with three things that night, a very interesting journal entry, a timeless story, and an incredibly happy three-year-old. But they also went home 20 hundred dimes poorer than before. But don't worry, those baby blankets, they did not go to waste. No, my mother used them for every single one of her children she had after me. And when our youngest was finally too old, she took the baby blankets, beloved, and wrapped them up in a box and placed on the box a note to remind her that when Elise is finally lucky enough to have children of her own, she can inherit the very expensive baby blankets and wrap her own kids in a physical symbol of their mother's curiosity, brilliance, and maybe a little bit of mischief, all in the form of the most expensive baby blankets ever bought.
Isn't that such a delightful story? If you have a sibling like I do, then you know siblings make for some of the best story material out there. It is a hoot. Anyway, this is the time in the program when we are shifting to our last couple of stories that are a little bit more spooky in nature, but are still some of our favorites. So if you are not a fan of ghosts and monsters, this is where we leave you, and we hope you've enjoyed. But our next story is again from Laurie Allen, and it is a Western legend known as The Lady in White. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Laurie Allen, and I'm a storyteller. I've been a storyteller for more years than most of us can remember. And this happens to be what I'm going to tell today, a legend of the Old West. Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. If that mockingbird don't sing, Mama's gonna buy you a diamond ring. In the days of the Old West, there were a lot of towns that sprang up along the wagon trails. People could make pretty good money with their little trading posts. Most everything was done in barter. But as people went across the plains, sometimes they discovered that they didn't need Grandma's old bureau as much as they needed sugar or flour, and so pretty good deals could be made. Hank ran one of these trading posts, and while he liked to make a good deal, Hank was also very honest. One evening, just at closing time, a woman came into Hank's trading post. She was wearing a long white dress, and she looked very disturbed. As she came in, Hank could tell pretty quickly that she was unable to speak. So he began lifting things off the shelves to see what it is she wanted to buy. No, she didn't need sugar. No, she didn't need tea. No. Finally, he reached from the top shelf a small tin of milk. Yes, that's what she wanted. Well, he pushed the tin of milk across the counter toward her, trying to figure out how he was going to explain the barter system to her, when she grabbed that milk and left, leaving behind a garnet ring. Now, this disturbed Hank, because that ring was worth a lot more than that tin of milk. And so he picked up the ring, he went outside to try to explain it to her, but she was nowhere to be seen. So he took the ring back in, he put it in a drawer, he locked up his shop for the night. The next evening, just at closing, this same woman with this haunted look upon her face came in and began gesturing toward the milk. He took out the ring, he pushed it toward her. No, she didn't want the ring, she wanted the milk. So finally, he pulled down the milk, he pushed both items toward her. She grabbed the milk and left, leaving behind some pearl earrings. This was too much for Hank. He picked up the jewelry, he went outside trying to explain to her. But when he looked up and down the street, she was nowhere to be seen. Well, he knew what to do. He went in, he put the jewelry in a drawer, closed it up, locked up his shop, and waited till the next evening. And yes, the next evening, this same woman came in, looking more distressed than ever, gesturing toward the milk. Hank got out the jewelry, he pushed it toward her. No, she didn't care about the jewelry, she wanted the milk. So he finally took the milk down, he pushed all the items toward her, and she grabbed that milk and she left, leaving behind a pearl necklace. This was too much. Hank picked up all the jewelry. He stepped outside. He looked up and down the street. He walked clear to the end of town, looking for anyone he could ask about this woman. But no one knew anything about her. Finally, as he got just to the edge of town, there was a stranger that came walking up. A man, he said he was
the master of a wagon train that was some distance out of town, and he had come in that evening to see what his people could trade for the next day. And when he saw that jewelry, he looked very concerned. You see, a cholera epidemic had swept through their camp about 3 days ago. He had buried a woman with her young child, and she was wearing that jewelry. No, no, Hank said, I did not take this. I'm not a thief. I can prove it to you. How? Well, we can go out to the grave. You'll find I did not take this jewelry. Well, the wagon master agreed if Hank could find a couple of fresh horses and some tools. And so they collected all of that and they rode. And with some good riding, they got to the newly dug grave just as the sun was coming up over the mountains. They dug down, they lifted up the coffin, and with a lever, raised the lid. Inside the coffin was the very woman that had been into Hank's store the last 3 evenings. She was wearing no jewelry, but beside her was a young baby, and the baby was still alive. And if that horse and cart fall down, you'll still be the sweetest little baby in town.
All right. How's that for a ghost story? It is so delightful, but also sweet in a certain way. Our next story is just straight up terrifying, and it is our final story for this episode of The Best of 2025. This is one of my personal favorites. It is from friend of the show, Elizabeth Gibson, who we heard earlier with The Cat and the Camellias, and this is her story from Appalachia, known as Taylee Poe. This is a story of ghostly monsters and vengeance and the terrors of living in the woods. So sit back, enjoy, and get ready for a fright.
I am Elizabeth Gibson. I am a professional storyteller. I've been telling for about 6 years now. I come from a Southern family where storytelling was pretty much a family tradition. And then when I found out years later that it actually is also a professional career, then I became really excited to know that and haven't really looked back last 6 years. So I've told at festivals, and I love to tell in intimate settings as well. So today, for my first story, I am going to tell an old Appalachian folktale. Now, my stories deal with the supernatural. In the South, there are three types of spook tales. The first one are haint stories or ghost tales. The second are tales about conjure women or witch tales. And then the third type is about some type of supernatural varmint or animal, and those are called booger tales. So Taylee Poe, although out west it's often referred to as being an Appalachian ghost story, it's actually a booger tale. So here we go, Taylee Poe. Long, long ago, there lived a really old man in a very old cabin on a mountaintop surrounded by a thick, dense, dark forest. Now, this man lived all alone except for his three hunting dogs, Uno, Ino, and Kumtko Calico. Now, these were times of great hunger and want. So one day, the old man went out on his porch and he called his three dogs, Uno, Ino, Kumtko Calico, here, here, here. And the dogs came out from under the porch and bounded up to their master. Today, we have to go a-hunting, or tonight we're going to go to bed hungry. So he went inside and got his hunting hat, his hunting coat and satchel, and his rifle, and off they went deep into the dense, thick forest. They were there all day, and at the end, all they caught was one rabbit. And the old man said,
hunting all day, and all I have to show for it is one scrawny rabbit. But what could he do? So they went home. He skinned the rabbit, chopped it up, put it in a pot with water and vegetables, and then stirred it for a long time. When it was finished, he had a bowl and then gave the rest to his dogs. "I'm still gonna be hungry," the old man said. But what could he do but go to bed? And so he did. He pulled the covers up, and soon he had drifted off to sleep. Somewhere in the middle of the night, he was awakened by a strange sound, and it went like this. Screech, scratch, screech, scratch, coming from the walls of the outside of the cabin, and the old man sat up in bed. Screech, scratch. He looked across on the opposite side of the wall, opposite from his bed, and there was a little chink hole between the two logs. And as he stared at it, screech, scratch, a head popped through, and it had long, skinny ears, eyes that glowed red gold, and long fingers like claws. And it slithered out through the chink hole and began coming across the wall of the cabin towards him. Screech, scratch. And the old man shuddered under the covers and went, oh, oh. And screech, scratch. Very carefully, he reached his right arm up and felt for the handle of an axe that was mounted on the cabin wall next to his bed. And he waited, screech, scratch. And he waited, screech, scratch. And whack! Down it came, and he separated the tail of the varmint from the varmint. And the thing went screaming across the cabin wall and out through the chink hole. And the old man was left holding this big, thick tail. And he said, "I'm gonna make myself some stew." So he took the tail and he skinned it and chopped it up and put it in the pot with some water and the rest of his vegetables. And he stirred it for a long time. When it was done, he had a bowl and then another one. And then he gave what remained to his dogs. And now when he went to bed, he wasn't hungry anymore. So he pulled up the covers and quickly went off to sleep. Somewhere in the middle of the night, he heard a ruckus out by the split rail fence that went around the perimeter of his property. He heard a clanging and a banging and a knocking and a dropping and a screeching and a scratching, and then suddenly it stopped and he heard,
Tailypo, all I want is my tailypo.
And the old man jumped up and he ran to the door. He flung it open. He called his dogs. Uno, Anno, come to go, Calico. Here, here, here. They came out from under the porch and bounded up to their master. Get it. He pointed towards the varmint, and they went out after him. They went yipping, yipping, and jumped over the split rail fence, up over the hill, down into the ravine, up over the next hill. And they heard he heard the barking go softer and softer, softer as they chased that varmint. And he listened, and then soon the barking grew louder as they came back, down into the ravine, up over the hill, up over the fence, and back to their master. Good dog, he said. And they went back under the porch. He came in, closed the cabin door, got into bed, pulled up the cover. And eventually, he went off to sleep. Somewhere a little while longer, a little later, a wind picked up down in the valley and began to whirl and swirl and whip up around the tops of the mountains and in the trees. And somewhere in the breeze, he heard,
Daily Bow. Daily Bow. I'm coming to get my Daily Bow.
And the voice got louder and closer and louder and closer. And the old man sat up in bed. And then he jumped up and he went to the door and he flung it open and he called his dogs. Uno, Anno, come to Go Calico, here, here, here. And the dogs came out from under the porch and bounded up to their master. Go get it, he yelled, and off they went, yipping and yapping, up over the split rail fence, over the hill, down into the ravine, up over the next hill. And then he heard them going farther and farther until he could hear them no longer. And he waited. And he waited. That thing had taken those dogs and led them deep down into the swamp and had lost them. And the old man knew that now he was all alone. But what could he do? He backed back into the cabin, closed the door, took the big wooden bolt and placed it over the door. He grabbed some rags and he stuck them into the chink hole between the two logs. And then he backed back into his bed and laid down, pulled the kivers up close to his chin. And he stayed awake a long time. But eventually, sleep overtook him. And he drifted off. Suddenly, he was awakened by a weird noise. It was the scratch, 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 scratch on the outside of the cabin walls. Scratch, scratch. The rags went out of the chink hole down the cabin walls. Scratch, scratch across the floor. Scratch, scratch till that thing stopped somewhere on the floor right at the foot of the bed. The old man looked down at his feet, and up popped a head. And it had long, skinny ears, eyes that glowed red gold, and long fingers like claws. And the thing looked the man square in the face and said,
"You know, and I know, I'm coming to get my Daily Bow."
And the old man sat up in bed and he said, "I ain't got your Daily Bow."
"Yes, you have. You have got my Daily Bow."
And the thing scratched everything all to pieces. Today, all that exists of the old man's cabin is the stone chimney that stands like a lone sentinel on the top of the hill. But down in the valley, folks say that when the moon is full and the wind picks up in the valley and whirls and swirls around the mountaintops and into the trees, you can sometimes hear a voice and it says,
"Daily Bow. Daily Bow. Now I've got my Daily Bow."
I hope you didn't get too scared with that story, but it is such a delightful taste of Appalachian folklore. And I hope you have enjoyed this wonderful guided tour through some of our best stories from our very first year of the show. And I hope you'll join us as we head into 2026. There's going to be a lot more fantastic storytellers, great content. And if you follow us on YouTube, we are going to have a lot more video-based content. So be ready for that. I hope you enjoyed, and as always, keep telling stories. The Story Arc is a production of Food for Thought Audio. This episode was written, produced, and edited by me, Kenny Mears. I'd like to thank today's storytellers for all that they have contributed to the show, as well as all of our other storytellers who didn't, unfortunately, make it into this episode. They bring such a light to our lives through their stories, and this show wouldn't be possible without them. As always, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, or wherever you listen to your podcasts for more content. And please do so. Share this episode with your friends if you want to give them a little taste of what we're working with here. And as always, thanks for your messages. We read them all. And thanks for listening.